Training in Oakland on Wednesday. And basically, for what I want to say, I don't have to tell you exactly what that's all about, but real quickly, trauma stewardship, Laura Link-Lipsky, or I forget her last name actually, founded the Trauma Stewardship Institute. She's a practitioner who has created this service to help professionals who work with in various fields where there's a lot of trauma, EMTs, psychiatric professions, emergency room nurses, firemen, policemen, firewomen, policewomen, folks who run the risk of trauma exposure, or secondary trauma, it's sometimes called, and how to work positively with the fact that you've chosen suffering, you've chosen to live and work in the proximity of suffering, and that inevitably has an effect. And unattended, it has a cumulative toll that can be dysfunctional, can be, dare I say, pathological. And so in this training, and so that's basically what the training is about, and various ways to understand trauma and being in contact with trauma. In the course of the training, she elucidated shamatha vipassana for me. I don't even know if she was aware that she was elucidating shamatha vipassana for me. Maybe she was. But she said something that I think really effectively illustrates it. And shamatha vipassana, in the way that I'm using the terms, is shikantaza, just sitting. It's also the way that Pema Chodron uses it, which she got from Trungpa Rinpoche. It's something we do at the same time. In the earlier schools of Buddhism, there were separate practices, more methodical, more deliberate. And you would do shamatha or calm abiding, and you would really try to develop deep, one pointed concentration to the exclusion of all else. You know how we say that we don't try to stop our thinking. We leave the front door and the back door of our mind open. We just don't get bothered by our thinking, but we don't get involved in it either. In formal shamatha practice, you endeavor to get one-pointed enough to where thinking stops, and you endeavor to sustain that and to let go of various other things in the process. That's not how I'm using the term shamatha. Likewise, vipassana, in earlier schools, you know, you you take the arising of dharmas and you try to get insight into their impermanence through concentrated attentiveness to the arising and passing of dharmas, and experience impermanence and experience emptiness. You're trying to develop insight into shunya very intentionally, very methodically. That is not what Trungpa Rinpoche and Pema Chodron taught when they used samatha vipassana as basically one word, one practice. And that's certainly not shikantata. So that's just a little background to what Laura said. She's talking in as far as developing a healthy practice towards secondary trauma, the virtue of slowing down. Very important to deliberately slow down for two things. So you feel what there is to be felt. You feel what you need to feel, which is the vipassana side. If you're stressed, there's clear awareness that you're stressed. If you're numbing down, you have insight into the fact that that's what's happening. You're numbing down. And you drop the rationalizations of why it's okay to be callous, why it's okay to crack sarcastic jokes about the victims of trauma. And you see, this is numbing down. So, and if you're hypervigilant, then there's direct awareness that you're hypervigilant. So slowing down, so you feel what you feel. There's the vipassana, there's the insight. And then samatha is slowing down to recognize what's going well, which is very interesting. And I've been contemplating this a lot. And I'm proposing this as maybe it's too much to say it's a working definition of samatha, but it's one feature of samatha. Slowing down and recognizing what's going well. You're in the environment, there's trauma, there's suffering, there's pain, but people are getting their meds on time. Or there's good morale today in the work environment. Or so-and-so is actually beginning to cure and thrive. Or Fred got a job, but he hasn't taken crack in several weeks. So as I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about this in the context of practice, of Dharma practice, what does it mean to cultivate the awareness of what's going well? There's a lot of stuff that's not going so well. The federal government's not doing so well financially right now. It's constantly on the news. And Syria, it's not going so well. There's a lot of things we can look at, a lot of dysfunction that beckons our attention. Well, the federal government might be shut down, might be offline, but the sun's not offline. The sun's impermanent too. There will come a time when it will go offline. But right now it's doing okay. There's this thing to the east of us called the San Andreas Fault. Is it still east of us? I don't know when it starts to go into the ocean. It's quiet right now. The earth isn't shaking right now. I can still see. I can still hear the sound of a skateboard coming down the street is still wondrous, and the sound of a crow and the leaves, that the wind is blowing the leaves across the road out there. There are things going okay all the time. We don't have to make that happen. It's not something that we contrive through effort. It's merely a matter of slowing down enough to be present to what is. Both these practices, slowing of shamatha and vipassana, slowing down enough to recognize what is. Recognizing what's in our heart and mind right now. Clear awareness of stress, if that is what is arising. Clear awareness of boredom, if that's what is arising. Of frustration, of desire. Just to see it. The insight side of Zazen, of Shikantaza, is, you know, various things come up and knock on the door of our awareness. We're sitting there and we're just sitting. We're attending to our breath, and the memory of an event that occurred yesterday that was distressing knocks on the door of our awareness. Well, we look and say, "Oh, hi. Hi, distress. I see you, but I can't welcome you in right now. I'm doing zazen." So close the door. You see clearly, you know, what arises. You pay attention to the arising and passing of all phenomena. Whether it's the sound of the leaves or the arising of a memory or a feeling of anxiety or a feeling of bliss, without attaching to it, without getting involved in it. So the effort is subtle, but the effort is so necessary. In order to, the effort is to slow down and be present. So there is a focus. You know, a lot of practitioners go through their Zen life feeling kind of vague about Zazen. And kind of get locked into, if you'll forgive me, a half-asleep mode on the seat, where there's no effort, no clear effort, because they've been taught that, you know, no gaining idea. They've been taught, you know, we're not trying to attain anything, and we're not trying to attain anything. But we're also not wanting to be playthings of our own karma and just spin. We won't find that place of ease, of perfect composure, if we don't make any kind of effort. But if we are pursuing some cookie, if we're pursuing some object that we want to get a hold of, our hearts hold no peace either. So it won't do not to make effort. It won't do to just spin your wheels on your cushion. Because I've gone through periods of time in my Zen career where I was kind of ambiguous about, and I still have times of ambiguity about how to make effort on the cushion. And what happens there is kind of similar, occurs to me, to the results of cumulative exposure to trauma. Your worldview can become, when you have cumulative exposure to trauma, your worldview can become warped. Laura gives the example. She went to Hawaii with her family for some reunion event, and they went to this gorgeous cliffside place, you know, a deep plummet to the Pacific. And she's sitting there saying, "Geez, I wonder how many people have flung themselves to their death off this cliff. Where would the helicopter land? Geez, it's not a very flat spot anywhere. Where's the nearest trauma treatment center?" You know? And then her father-in-law, and she thought nothing of this, and so she kind of like shared her thoughts with, you know, her family, and her father-in-law says, "Laura, could it be all this trauma work is starting to affect you?" You know? And so the constant exposure to trauma, unattended to, you know, a new normal, a maladaptive normal within one's heart and mind starts to set in. And I think that, you know, one of the malaise that a Zen student might suffer, if they lose beginner's mind, if they lose that zeal to make an effort and just accept the monkey mind as one's natural state is a normal state of mild frustration and resignation about practice sets in. Oh yeah, it's the hounds going off, like I'm going to the Zendo now. No getting idea. So I'm just going to sit and wait for the bell to ring. And accept that as the normal state, which is sad. Because without some sincere effort, dwelling in that place, letting our hearts be nourished by that place right now, where things are going well, it's not really accessible. It may be an intellectual construct for us that, yeah, things are perfect just the way they are. But the peace that comes from actually dwelling there takes some effort. But not an effort to get anywhere or to construct a new state of mind. And I was reading Master Sheng then, and I think he has a new image for effort that I really find intriguing. One effort, one metaphor for Suzuki Roshi talks about our effort goes from achievement to non-achievement. One image for that, the classical image, is a glass of water that has sediment in it, and the water is, you know, agitated, so there's turbidity, and the mud is all mixed into the water. But if you set the glass down and leave it alone, the sediment gradually settles to the bottom. You know, leave your mind alone. If you try to fix your mind, you're only going to agitate it more. Very, very true. And that's an image for it. But that image doesn't clarify how to make effort. You know, because you can set the glass down and go play poker, and it'll still settle down. You don't have to attend to it to get the sediment down. But Sheng, I'm going to share some from Sheng Yan to share his image, which gives a sense of effort, while at the same time he also reiterates that don't try to get anything, don't try to pursue anything, but there is a way to make effort. And this is from, the book is Faith in Mind, his commentary, a retreat that he led on the Shin Chen Ning, the third ancestor's famous treatise. And it starts out, the supreme way is not difficult if only you don't pick and choose. Neither love nor hate, and you will clearly understand. Be off by a hair. So, be off by a hair, and you as far from it as heaven from earth. So you don't pick and choose, and yet, so there's no pick and choose, no gaining idea. But if you're off by a hair, you're as far from that place where everything is well as heaven is from earth. Or when I was, my first practice period with Mel, we studied this, and he said the Chinese could also be read, if you're off by a hair, then heaven and earth are separate. Nirvana and samsara are different. So it's like, there's no difference between heaven and earth unless you're not present, if you're not aligned. It's one way to, and I like that reading of the Chinese. So this is what Sheng Yan Bhikshu says. The sole purpose of Chan, retreat, is to meditate. You should keep your attention entirely on your practice without trying to attain any results. So the sole purpose, and that, just reading that reminds me of something Suzuki Roshi said on that video. He says, mind, body, consciousness, Buddha, is our mind itself and our body itself. When our mind and body is one with our surroundings, that is reality. So, to make our best effort on each moment, forever, is our practice. Now, if you're going to make your best effort each moment, then there's no place to stop. There's no goal to attain. But the effort itself is the goal, if you will. So that I heard a resonance to that when he says, the sole purpose of a chan retreat is to meditate, is to practice. You should keep your attention entirely on your practice. Make your best effort at each moment forever, without trying to attain anything, with any results. Since many of you have traveled far or have worked hard to set aside the time to come to this retreat, you have a great deal invested in this retreat. You know, people spend a lot of money to do a practice period at Tassajara or a sesshin at Tassajara or Green Gulch. You know, they take their hard-earned vacation time and their hard-earned money, and they spend it all to get nothing. Practicing with a goal in mind is, here's the image. Here's the image, you know, that I want to contrast with the image of the turbid water in the glass. Practicing with a goal in mind is like trying to catch a feather with a fan. The more you go after it, the more it eludes you. Okay, there's a feather coming down, you have this fan, and you're trying to get the feather, and of course the fan blows the feather away, you know. So if you're trying to get zazen, if you're trying to get a calm mind, the calm mind blows away. But if you sneak up on it slowly, you can grab it. So if you're watching, if you're attentive to the feather, very attentive to the feather, and just kind of like wait for the feather to fall on the fan, then the feather and the fan can meet. If you're pursuing the feather with the fan, then the pursuit knocks it away. So there's this attentiveness, letting the feather do what it needs to do, but staying with it, attentive to it, letting it sink down onto the fan. So I think that's analogous to the effort. Our effort is to be present, as Ram Dass said, to be here now. And on one level we could say, well, where else can I be? I'm not in Jersey, you know. But on another level, we know that, the present moment is wild and spontaneous. It can't be grabbed. Our minds can grab onto all kinds of things, but the present moment is elusive and intangible, and yet within its form, yet within its essence, Lao Tzu says. It's not something we can get a hold of, but it is something we can receive. And so it takes an effort. It takes intention. But it's a soft, gentle, but vigilant effort. Rigorous vigilance and consummate softness. The aim of practice is to develop patience and forbearance, to train your mind to be calm and stable. Any attachment or seeking will prevent your mind from settling down. Any attachment or seeking will prevent your mind from settling down. So, the main thing is to, when Suzuki Roshi gives instructions about Shikantaza and Zenmai beginner's mind, he says, to settle the awareness on the breath, Don't be bothered by the various images you'll have in your mind. Let them come, let them go. Eventually they will settle down. Within 5 or 10 minutes, he says, they'll settle down. But then later he says, it may take a long time to find your calm mind in your practice. So he seems to contradict himself. But he says, at first your effort is rough and impure. But eventually it will evolve into some subtle feeling. So that's what we're looking for, is that subtle feeling of not trying to control your mind, not trying to control your heart, not pursuing some special experience, but attending to whatever is present, like watching that feather, wafting, and attending carefully enough so that you're ready to receive it. Subtle effort to practice honing your sense of what it means to make effort to be present. Using the breath, not for the sake of the breath, but using the breath as the handle of a cup. And if you are present to the breath, if you grab the handle of the cup and lift, the cup comes with it. A subtle attentiveness to the breath that allows the fullness of the present moment to be there with it, in its spontaneity, in its wildness, in its unpredictability. Without that subtle grasping or settling with the breath, without that openness to the wildness and the spontaneity, the unpredictability of the moment, there's no room for insight. You've closed the door on insight because you've created a little cave for yourself. Hence the necessity for honing a subtle sense of what it means to stay present in this moment, using the breath as an aid but not the point. And so you craft that subtle understanding of how to make effort. Then you notice, in some meditation manuals they talk about you have a vigilant monitor. You leave space in your mental energy to have a monitor. In the early stages of shamatha practice, they talk about this. And in the later stages, you can let go of that effort to have a monitor. In the first stages, you have a monitor present to say, are you doing the practice or not? Are you aware of the object or not? And then when you get stability on the object, the effort to sustain that monitor is a bit of an irritation, a bit of distraction. And then you can ease it off some. So, and I'm starting to make it like a method or a formula, of course, please forgive me for that. But one part of the method is to craft that subtle, the subtle nature of the effort. You're not looking for anything in particular, but you're there. You're there. And then the other piece is to notice if you're making that effort or not. If the front and the back door of your mind are still open, or if you've hopped on a thought and gone for a ride. So those two things. No expectation, not looking for anything, but vigilant to be honest with yourself. Am I making effort or not? Am I on my seat? Am I making my best effort to be on my seat in the fullness of this or not? If you don't have any working definition, forgive me, of effort, you won't be able to monitor that. But if you think, I got to hang on to the breath and I got to reject everything else, and it may be tied up in knots, and you're not going to be able to find that place of ease. Find that place that right now things are going well. The sun is shining. I'll close with a poem that just occurred to me that I'm pretty sure I have in my magic box here. I'm pretty sure I've got the wild geese in this iPod. Oh no, am I wrong? I haven't made a copy of the wild geese. I've got other Mary Oliver poems in here, but not that one. I've I'm surprised. I thought I had that. Darn it. Well, anyway, I'm going to try to remember the essence of the poem, and it's probably not going to be very lyrical. You don't have to repent. You don't have to go crawling on your hands and knees through the desert. You don't have to get a special state of mind. You don't have to get enlightened. You only have to let that soft animal of your body love what it loves. Speak to me of your despair, and I'll tell you mine. Meanwhile, the sun is still shining. And the wild geese are flying. Calling. Harshly. Calling you to your place in the world of things. There's more to the poem that I've missed. And I probably didn't, and I rephrase certain things, forgive, but that's the essence. And you hear what it's saying. You know. We don't have to suffer the unnecessary suffering that we put ourselves through. We're perfect just the way we are. We don't have to change ourselves. Well, we could use some improvement. We could learn how to let the soft animal of our body love what it loves, what it truly loves. It would be good to clarify what our inmost desire actually is, and the cheap, tawdry desires that we think we want to get some insight about all that stuff. Because the sun is shining. We've been given everything that we could possibly need. Everything's a gift. Yeah, pretty, I almost want to use the F-bomb. Pretty freaking amazing gift it is. But something about, but it requires effort. Requires effort. I forget how many gazillions of tons of hydrogen the sun converts into light each minute. It's, in the realm of physics, a certain kind of work is happening in the sun, a certain kind of energy, a certain kind of effort, if you will, is happening. It's effortless effort. The sun isn't, I don't hear the sun complaining. how do we get with the cosmic program? How do we make our effort so that it harmonizes with the effort of the sun and the effort of photosynthesis and the call of the wild geese? How do we find that subtle effort that brings us home, where everything is well? And if we touch upon that place that's well, we can't have it. But our faith is refreshed. And we get some clarity about effort. So I humbly ask you to study the mystery. Don't spend your days and nights in vain. Each moment of zazen is a wonderful opportunity. Bring all of yourself to it. Okay? You ready to sign on the dotted line? Any questions? Any comments? Yes.
Just with relation to focusing on the problems of the world, which I tend to do a lot. Mm-hmm. I've been reading a book called Who is the Brain?
I've read it, yeah.
It's pretty good. What it does is it sort of elucidates why the brain tends to do that.
Yeah.
Because in an evolutionary sense, it makes sense to pay attention to things that are that are dangerous.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because if you miss something that's dangerous, you're dead.
Yeah.
But if you miss something that's nice, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And so that really was a great clarification for me. And it's and I guess what it is sort of forgiving yourself on a certain level for being the way we are. Because we didn't have anything to do with that structure that we now possess, but that's what we've got.
Yeah.
And so that was really a wonderful insight for me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's another piece to it that I think could be helpful. And, you know, I got this from the trauma stewardship workshop. Mm-hmm. The fight, flight, or fright mechanism, you know, where the brainstem or the amygdala, I'm not sure which, when there's danger, when there's threat, you know, adrenaline pumps into the system to deal with it, to run or to attack or something. And then in the quote-unquote natural world, the tiger, you know, when they've done what they needed to do, then they look around, well, what can I eat, you know, or can I find a mate, you know, they just drop it. But we have this prefrontal cortex, this impulse control mechanism. So we've had this impulse to choke the heck out of our boss, but we don't, you know. And so there's no discharge, or there sometimes is no discharge, that, you know, we're immobilized, but we don't act it out to discharge it, and it kind of like lingers in our system. And so that one piece of that is to recognize when you've been triggered, when your primitive brain has responded to a perceived threat, and then finding a way. You know, a friend of mine is doing this trauma releasing work where they actually they shake, like, you know, like tremors. You know, it's one way of discharging the adrenaline, or, you know, somehow acknowledging the fact that, you know, a part of your brain's been mobilized that's released these chemicals, and that and you know, something needs to be done to metabolize that or discharge that. So it's kind of like, you know, certain elements of modern life trigger our primitive brain, but we have social constraints from the natural way of responding to those triggers. We don't usually choke our bosses. Mm-hmm. Occasionally somebody does go postal, and, you know, maybe there's a leak there too, that our societal system doesn't. One of the things that this woman said is, you know, our societal systems tend not to support healthy ways of discharging when we've been triggered, when our primitive brain's been triggered, and we don't know how to process that, we don't know how to deal with that. And maybe that's one reason why people sometimes snap, because they're under this constant pressure. You know, their karma has created this block, maybe. I'm speculating, I don't know. So yeah, I think that's an important practice piece. The forgiveness piece, yes, you know, we're human, and this is how we're wired. Let's not beat ourselves up for being wired to being wired, but let's also try to develop a new intelligence to cope with it.
Yeah, the other thing is that it doesn't necessarily take an outside event either.
Yeah.
You know, your brain has all of these traumas that are stored from the past, that spontaneously sort of come up.
Yeah.
And that's what I notice when I'm on the cushion a lot.
Yes.
You know, things just come up.
Yeah, yeah. And that's that piece of slowing down to feel what you need to feel.
Right.
Okay. Let's see. So why don't we chant our chant, and then maybe another 5 minute kin hymn, and then we'll sit until noon and do a little service.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Shujo Nguyen Se Gan Do Bon Ho Jin Se Gan Dan. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.